The following is from a confession written by 17-year-old Jake Evans on October 4th, 2012. I had just got home from the allergist and had lunch when I started watching Rob Zombie's Halloween. In the movie, a 12-year-old boy murders his stepfather, sister, and his sister's boyfriend. It was the third time this week that I watched it. While watching it, I was amazed at how at ease the boy was during the murders and how little remorse he had afterwards. I was thinking to myself, it would be the same for me when I kill someone. After I watched the movie, I put it back in the case and threw it in the trash can so that people wouldn't think that it influenced me in any way. After that, I went outside to hit golf balls in the yard for about an hour. I went inside around 5:30 p.m. and just sat in the living room, thinking about how I was going to kill my family. My plan was to kill my sister and my mom at my house, and then go over to my grandparents and kill my oldest sister, Emily, and my two grandparents. Then I was going to wait until morning and kill my other sister, Audrey, because she was visiting from college. After I got up from the couch, it was between 6 and 6:30. My grandma had called my mom to ask if I wanted to go to the cleaners with her. I went, and while we were in town, we got dinner. We made a quick stop at the post office, and then she dropped me off at my house. I took my dinner to the pool house and watched Family Guy for a little bit. I went back into the house and saw that my mom and sister were watching the debate. I went outside again to swing freely with my golf club. Around 9 p.m., I went upstairs in my house to watch Family Guy. About 10 minutes later, my sister came upstairs and asked if I wanted to watch a movie. I said no, because earlier that day at the allergist appointment, she made racist comments about a black worker that was mowing the grass. In the past, Mallory had always said racist comments like that and would also make fun of homeless people. I scolded her for what she said and told her that she was becoming white trash. We continued arguing in the doctor's office, and when we got back into the car, I told her to look up the word lynching and to see if she had the same opinion about black people. She then said that she would never be a part of a lynching, but is still a racist. I then said that she makes me sick and called her a racist bitch. So that evening, after I told her I didn't want to watch a movie, she went to her room, and I went downstairs to my parents' closet, and I got my dad's blue foldable knife. I went back upstairs and kept pacing back and forth, imagining killing Mallory. Thoughts of causing her pain kept entering my mind and were really bothering me. But then I'd think about the time she hurt my feelings or really pissed me off. So finally, around 9:30, I knocked on her door and asked if she wanted to watch Waterboy. She said yes, and sat on the couch beside the sofa I was on. I told her that I was going to the art room to get a pin. When I was in the art room, I stood there again, imagining killing Mallory. After 30 minutes, I finally went in the room and sat on the sofa with a knife in my pocket. I sat for about 5 minutes and then playfully threw a pillow at Mallory. We started having a pillow fight in the room. After a while, I thought to myself that if I were to kill my mom and Mallory, I wouldn't want them to feel anything. So I decided to kill them both with the .22 revolver I stole from my grandpa. I told Mallory that I needed to go downstairs for a little bit. After I saw that my mom was in the study, I went to my closet and picked up the pistol. I set it on the bed and was nervously opening the cylinder over and over again. I then spent probably over an hour walking nervously around the house, thinking how life will never be the same and how I would never see them again. Around 11:15, I went upstairs with the pistol and stood there for about 5 minutes. I knocked on the door and told Mallory that Mom needed her. She came out and out of the corner of her eye saw me pointing the gun at her. She thought I was joking and told me that I was freaking her out. I shot her in the back and then the head. I ran down to the study and shot my mom 3 times. In shock, I ran in my room and was screaming at the top of my lungs that I am really messed up and that I killed my mom and sister. So I emptied the shells on my bed. I heard noises and realized that Mallory was still alive. While I loaded the gun back up, I was shouting that I was sorry, and then ran as fast as I could to go kill her. I then made sure my mom was dead and shot her again in the head. After the shooting, I walked outside for a few minutes and then came back inside. Very shocked and scared, I placed the gun on the kitchen counter and walked into the living room to dial 911. This is Jillian, and you're listening to Court Junkie, episode 38. In today's episode, we're going to focus on a juvenile offender in Texas who was accused of committing the ultimate crime, capital murder, and the sentence he faced. The 911 call came in just after midnight.
Ponca County 911, where is your emergency?
My house.
What's the address?
152 River Creek Lane.
Okay, what's the emergency?
I just killed my mom and my sister.
What?
I just killed my mom and my sister.
You just killed your mother and your sister? How did you do that?
I shot him with a .22 revolver.
And what is your name?
Jake Evans. Jake Evans.
Are you sure they're dead?
Yes.
I want you to stay on the phone with me, okay? Are you all right?
Yeah, I'm fine.
Okay. Hold on just a minute. Where is the gun?
It's on the kitchen counter.
Okay. It's a .22?
Yes.
Okay. Hold on. Jake?
Yes?
Are you on any kind of medication?
No. Well, I've been going to the allergist a lot lately.
Yeah.
With my mom. But no, nothing other than that.
Okay. How old are you?
17.
You don't take any other kind of medication?
I mean, other than, like, Zyrtec and, like, Advil and, you know, like, Sudafed and stuff like that, you know, for the allergies and headaches, but
yeah.
No.
The dispatcher remains calm as she tries to figure out the motive.
Okay, do you, is there any reason that you were so angry at your mother and your sister?
I don't know, I wasn't, it's weird, I wasn't even really angry with them, it just kind of happened. I've been kind of planning on killing for a while now.
The two of them, or just anybody?
Pretty much anybody.
Why?
I don't know, I don't really like people's kind of attitude.
Right.
I think they're kind of, they're very, emotional, I don't know, verbally rude to each other and stuff like that.
Right.
And, I don't know.
It's okay.
It's just my family, I don't know, they're just kind of really, I guess this is really selfish to say, but to me, I felt like they were just suffocating me in a way. I don't know. I think I'm, obviously, you know, I'm pretty, I guess, evil, but that's, whatever.
Okay.
Sorry.
No, don't be sorry. It's all right. I'm listening. Okay, you have my undivided attention.
Jake's calm voice starts to quiver as he tells her the details of what happened.
Were your mom and sister in their beds?
No. This this is really going to mess me up for this, you know, in the future. My sister, I told my sister that my mom needed her.
Mm-hmm.
She was in her room, and she came out of her room, and I shot her, and she rolled down the stairs, and I shot her again. And then I went down and I shot my mom about maybe 3 or 4 times, but I'll never forget this.
Okay, that's fine.
My sister, she came down the stairs and she was screaming, and I was telling her that I'm sorry, but to just hold still,
mm-hmm.
that, you know, I was just going to make it go away, you know, but she just kept on freaking out. But finally she fell down and I shot her in the head about probably 3 times.
So they're both downstairs?
Yes.
She asks him if he's sitting by the gun, and he says no. It's about 10 to 15 feet away from him. She asks where his dad is, and he tells her that his dad is out of town, in Washington, D.C. He then tells her that he doesn't want his family to visit him in jail.
And future reference, I don't really want to see any of my family members, you know, and visiting or whatever. I don't know how it works or anything, but I just don't want any type of visitors. I don't want to see.
Okay. Know.
She gets him talking about his home life. He tells her that he used to go to school, but is now being homeschooled, along with his sister Mallory. He has 2 other sisters. The eldest lives across the street with their grandparents, and the other one is away at college. He said she was supposed to come home tomorrow and visit the family. The dispatcher asks him if he wants to hurt himself.
You don't want to hurt yourself, do you?
I'm a little freaked out about guns now.
Oh, sure. But you don't want to hurt yourself.
I don't know. I definitely, you know, I assure you, I definitely don't like myself, you know. But I'm just so freaked out by guns now. And just to let you know, like, I hate the feeling of killing someone. I'm going to be messed up.
There are people that will help you.
She tells him to make sure to take deep breaths, that deputies are on their way, that they want to help him, not hurt him. He replies, "I understand if you all want to." And she tells him that no, they only want to help. She instructs him to turn the porch light on and tells him that when the police arrive, they'll ask him to come out. At one point, she asks him if he's okay, and he says that he's just thinking about his sister, who was 15. He said she had a sweet side, but that she was racist and really rude to him sometimes.
You'll be all right, Jake. Okay? You'll be all right.
I'm like, really worried about, like, you know, like, nightmares and stuff like that. Are there any type of medication for that and stuff?
Well, I think there is. I don't know. I'm not a doctor, but, you know, the justice system, and I'm sure your family will get you the support you need.
I don't mean to sound like a wimp or anything, but, you know, this is, wow. I've never, like, done anything violent in my whole life, you know?
You don't sound like a violent person. No, you don't.
She continues to encourage him to take deep breaths.
Deep breaths, honey. In through your nose, real deep.
I just thought it'd be quick, you know. I didn't want them to feel any pain. That's why I used a gun.
Okay.
But it was like everything went wrong.
It's all right. Keep breathing for me. Okay, just in through your nose, real slow out through your mouth.
She tells him that the officers are almost there and asks if he would be willing to walk out on his own. He says yes and tells her that there's a loaded gun on the counter. He says that for some reason, when he put it down, it was loaded. She tells him to keep his hands up and to walk outside. Police officers from the Park County Sheriff's Office responded to the home on River Creek Lane in Aledo, Texas. When they pulled up, Jake Evans was standing in front of the house waiting for them, his hands above his head. Jake's mother, 48-year-old Jamie Evans, and his sister, 15-year-old Mallory Evans, were found dead inside the house. A .22 caliber revolver was sitting on the kitchen table. The Evans family had moved into the River Creek gated community in 2000, which was 20 miles west of Fort Worth. The family was comprised of Jamie and her husband Daryl and their four children, Jake and his three sisters, Audrey, Emily, and Mallory. Jake's grandparents lived across the street, and by all accounts, they were a close, tight-knit family. According to Jamie's obituary, she and Daryl had been high school sweethearts, married for 26 years. Jamie had worked as an educator in the Aledo School District for more than 15 years, although she has spent the last few years homeschooling her youngest children, Jake and Mallory. She was described as very active in her community, church, Bible studies, and women's groups. Jamie had planned a big celebration for her grandmother, who was turning 100 years old, for the end of the month and had been looking forward to attending with her family. Mallory's obituary describes her as a fun-loving, kind, endearing daughter, sister, and aunt. She enjoyed playing all sports and was the life of the party, no matter where she was or who she was with. And she loved driving through the neighborhood on the golf cart with her brother Jake and her cousins. That same Jake was taken into custody and charged with capital murder. He reportedly told police that he had stolen the gun from his grandfather, who was a retired Fort Worth police officer, just 2 weeks prior. He also told police that he had searched the web for, quote, the 10 most evil teenagers / people. The local media was seemingly obsessed with the case, and when Jake's handwritten confession was leaked to the public, the case garnered national attention from publications like the New York Daily News, Huffington Post, and even Radar Online. Reporters seemed to hone in on the fact that Jake had mentioned watching Rob Zombie's Halloween prior to the killing. Headlines read, 17-year-old murder suspect inspired by Halloween slasher flick, and Halloween inspired Texas teen to kill mom and sister. The judge in Jake's case granted him a $750,000 bail. At his bail hearing, Jake's father told the judge that his son had no money, and while the family would be supporting him in jail, they would not be bonding him out, even if they could afford it. But there was a big legal issue standing in the way of Jake's case. Because punishments for 17-year-olds in Texas who are charged with capital murder were currently at a standstill. More on that in just a minute, after this quick break from our sponsor. If you love listening to Court Junkie, chances are you probably love listening to true crime podcasts, just like I do. I want to tell you about a unique true crime podcast I love called Unsolved Murders True Crime Stories that is a great twist on true crime and cold cases. Unsolved Murders is not just another true crime podcast. It's different. They have a staff of screenwriters, an ensemble of voice actors, and a talented digital production team working on every episode. Their dramatized scenes bring the cold cases to life alongside the host's analysis of each case. And what's really cool is at the end of each case, the host will tell you who they believe committed the crime. This is a true crime podcast, meaning all the facts and the cold cases are real. Check out cold cases like the Black Dahlia, the Pizen Hall murder, the Joan Robinson Hill murder, or the Zodiac. Unsolved Murders comes out every Tuesday. Visit Apple Podcasts, TuneIn, Stitcher, Spotify, Google Play, or your favorite podcast directory and search for Unsolved Murders True Crime Stories. Again, that's Unsolved Murders True Crime Stories, Or you can visit parcast.com/unsolved to start listening now. That's Parcast, parcast.com/unsolved to listen now. And now, back to the episode. Here's Jake's attorney, Larry Moore, telling reporters that they had filed a pre-trial writ application for habeas corpus, meaning they were trying to get Jake released from prison.
The United States Supreme Court has in two decisions, Roper versus Simmons and Miller versus Alabama, indicated that the only two statutory punishments provided in Texas for capital murder are inapplicable to a person under the age of 18 at the time of the commission of the crime. So the state is in a situation where they don't have a punishment that they can apply to him if they try him and convict him of capital murder. And what they're asking the judge to do is hold him in jail and make him answer to that charge until they have the opportunity to go to the legislature and try to get a new statute passed to establish a punishment that they can apply to him in the trial.
So what Larry Moore was saying here is that due to at least two Supreme Court rulings, the state of Texas didn't have a punishment for defendants under the age of 18 who are accused of capital murder. So what did that mean exactly? I wanted to find out more, and so I reached out to Elizabeth Henneke. Elizabeth was the perfect person to talk to. She's on the Juvenile Council for the State Bar of Texas and is an advisory member of the Juvenile Justice Committee for the Texas Judicial Council. And in addition to that, she also sits on the board of directors for the Campaign for Youth Justice, and she recently took on the executive director position at Lone Star Justice Alliance. Now, over the last 10 to 15 years, there have been some major changes to juvenile sentencing in the United States. But prior to that, juveniles who were charged with capital murder often faced the death penalty in Texas. According to deathpenaltyinfo.org, as of December 31st, 2004, 71 people in the United States were on death row for crimes they committed when they were juveniles. This constituted about 2% of the total death row population of 3,487. The death sentences had been handed out from 12 different states, but Texas had by far the largest death row for juvenile offenders, holding 40% of the national total. But in 2005, a case known as Roper v. Simmons changed that. 17-year-old Christopher Simmons had been sentenced to death in 1993 after being convicted of planning and executing the murder of his neighbor Shirley Crook. It was a damning case. He confessed, performed a videotaped reenactment, and one of his friends testified that he had not only discussed the plot with him, but that he had bragged about it afterwards. Simmons appealed his conviction, but the death sentence against him stood. That is, until Simmons filed a new petition for post-conviction relief, arguing that his death sentence was unconstitutional. The Supreme Court of Missouri agreed and held that the execution of juvenile offenders now violates the Eighth Amendment, which states, in part, that cruel and unusual punishments shall not be inflicted. They resentenced Simmons to life in prison without parole. The state of Missouri appealed the decision to the United States Supreme Court, which held that it was cruel and unusual punishment to execute a person who was under the age of 18 at the time of the murder. I asked Elizabeth Henneke to tell me more about the ruling in that case.
In Roper, the Supreme Court was asked, should we have the death penalty for kids under the age of 18? And one of the there were a couple of things at play. First was, what's the purpose of having the death penalty, and does it make sense for a juvenile? And the Supreme Court found that it doesn't make any sense because kids are less culpable than adults. They aren't able, they're more impulsive. They don't think through. They have all these, all the brain science that demonstrates that kids are different made applying the harshest punishment not reasonable. It was a proportional response to the actions that these kids had had. They also, very interestingly, found for the first time internationally. And they looked internationally and they said, look, the United States is one of a handful of countries that executes youth, and are the other people who do so are countries like Somalia. And do we really want to be a part of that club? And so that goes to the evolving standards of decency. And the Supreme Court found that evolving standards of decency, both within the United States and worldwide, had countered against using the sentence for kids under the age of 18.
In 2012, just months before Jake Evans was arrested for murdering his mom and sister, another Supreme Court case changed the way juveniles are sentenced. That case was Miller v. Alabama. On a summer night in 2001, 14-year-old Evan Miller and one of his friends saw one of Miller's neighbors passed out in his trailer. Miller and his friend decided to rob him, and as Miller pulled money out of the man's wallet, the man woke up, and so a fight broke out between the man and the two boys. Miller ended up beating the man using a baseball bat. And to cover it up, they set the trailer on fire, with the man still alive as the flames engulfed his home. Miller was convicted and sentenced to life without parole. He appealed his sentence, but kept getting denied. His attorney appealed to the United States Supreme Court, which agreed to hear the case.
And then in 2012 came Miller v. Alabama, right? Can you talk a little bit about that one?
Well, I think Miller versus Alabama is really important, although you can't really talk about it without talking about Graham. So I'm going to back up and talk about Graham first.
Okay. Sure.
If that's okay.
Yes, of
course. And Graham, which I believe is 2010, and Graham versus Florida, the Supreme Court found that we could not have a life without parole sentence for juveniles who did not commit a homicide. And the critical thing that comes out of that case is that the Supreme Court says, look, for youth, because they have such a strong capacity for rehabilitation, because they are so likely to change, it is a transient time in your life and you're going to change, you have to give them a meaningful opportunity for release if they haven't committed a homicide. We were all thrilled with that decision, and then along came Miller in 2012, and the Supreme Court doubled down on that philosophy, saying, look, not, you really do have to give them a meaningful opportunity for release, but you can't even sentence them to a life without parole sentence unless you look at the individual nature of their crime and conclude that this individual is one of the rare folks that could never be rehabilitated. And so the Supreme Court, Justice Kagan writing for the court, said, importantly, this will be very rare that you would ever even have a life without parole sentence, because kids are so capable of rehabilitation that it's only going to be the, you know, extremely rare individual that would not be capable of rehabilitation. And the state had to prove that all the facts up to that point had shown that this kid could no longer be rehabilitated. I think it raised the bar so high that it made life without parole a not only a rare sentence, but presumptively the Constitution does not permit that as a sentence for most offenders.
So therein lied the problem with the Jake Evans case. In Texas, 17-year-olds are considered adults, but due to Roper v. Simmons, the death penalty for them was off the table. And before Miller v. Alabama, that left a sentence of life in prison without parole, which was the mandatory sentence for a capital murder charge in Texas at the time. But after Miller v. Alabama, that was now void too. So this left no sentencing options for Jake when his case would go to court, which left it at a standstill for months and months, while his attorneys fought to have the capital murder charge dropped. And Jake's case wasn't the only one in limbo, so the Texas legislature had to do something.
In Texas specifically, like, that created a problem for 17-year-olds who were currently being charged with capital murder. Is that right? Because wasn't there, like, kind of,
yeah,
like, they had to, like, kind of figure out what to do with the sentencing for that offense?
Yeah, in the legislative session in 2013, the legislature, Texas legislature, was struggling with recognizing that the mandatory imposition of life without parole was no longer a justifiable sentence under Miller versus Alabama, and they were struggling with, well, what do we do? And there were actually two camps. So one camp said, well, we should just convert all of those cases to life with parole. While it wasn't really talked about at the time, I think there was an acknowledgement that our life with parole, mandatory life with parole, was very similar to life without parole. Again, because only 96%, because 96% aren't going to die in prison anyway. And then the other camp said, look, we need to individualize the sentence, even if you're going to give them life. We need to make sure that we are separating out the kids who truly deserve this prison, this sentence, and those that don't. And ultimately, the first camp won, and the, Texas decided that they would go ahead and sentence all kids who are convicted of capital murder, get mandatory life. And it technically complied with Miller versus Alabama because it eliminates the life without parole. It takes the P out of the sentence. But it's my opinion that they don't actually comply with Miller versus Alabama since, again, 96% are going to die in prison.
In July 2013, the Texas legislature finally amended the capital murder sentencing statutes and said that defendants under the age of 18 would now be punished with life in prison with the possibility of parole after 40 years. And so Jake Evans's case finally started making its way through the system again, but not without more road bumps. In September 2014, Jake's attorney filed two motions. One motion indicating that he would introduce evidence at trial that Jake was insane at the time of the murders, and the second one requesting that a judge determine whether Jake was even competent to stand trial. He said Jake had been examined by a forensic psychologist who concluded that he was not competent to stand trial, and he wrote that he had noticed some things about Jake himself that had led him to come to that conclusion as well. A month later, after another forensic psychologist agreed that Jake was not competent, the judge ordered that he be sent to a mental hospital. He was admitted into the maximum security North Texas State Hospital in Vernon for up to 120 days. Prosecutors in the case said in a news release that they agreed with the judge's ruling and said, quote, "It's important to point out that this finding does not mean that Mr. Evans will not face trial on the capital murder charges. It just means that he will not face trial until the professionals at the North Texas State Hospital can assist him in regaining competency." A few months later, Jake's competency was restored, but the next hearing that would take place in Jake's case wouldn't be a pretrial hearing. It would be a plea hearing. In April 2015, almost 3 years after the murders, Jake pleaded guilty to two counts of murder in exchange for 45 years in prison. The state agreed to waive the capital murder charge. Jake's family was in court, and his attorney read a letter they wrote in support of that plea deal. The letter said, quote, "The undersigned family members of Jacob Jake Evans, Jamie Evans, and Mallory Evans appreciate the state's plea bargain offer of 45 years on two counts of murder to run concurrently as the disposition of this case. We feel that this is a fair plea bargain under all circumstances, even though our family would support a lesser sentence than 45 years if it was possible to do so in this case. The family realizes that Jake will have to serve at least half of the assessed time before he becomes eligible for parole. We are unanimous in our support of Jake's decision to plead guilty and be assessed 45 years by the judge, rather than have a capital murder trial. None of us want Jake and our family to be subjected to a capital murder trial, which we feel would not be in his and our family's best interests. We wish to close this chapter of our lives in order to continue healing as a family." The letter was signed by Jake's father, two surviving sisters, grandparents, aunts, and uncles. When asked later by reporters why the state decided to offer the plea deal, Prosecutor Robert Du Bois said that although the Texas legislature had fixed the sentencing issue for capital murder, he wasn't sure whether that fix would hold up and stand constitutional scrutiny. He cited that, the family's wishes, and Jake's age and lack of a criminal history as the reasons that the plea deal was the best solution. He called the family's forgiveness inspiring and said, quote, "With how quickly they forgave him and how wholly they embraced him, it's just awe-inspiring to see that amount of love for this kid." Jake will serve at least half of his sentence, or 22 and a half years, before he will be eligible for parole. He will receive credit for the 2.5 years already served. A special thank you to Elizabeth Henneke from the Lone Star Justice Alliance for her help in explaining those Supreme Court rulings. If you want to learn more about the topic of juvenile sentencing in Texas, I have great news. I'll be releasing a Court Junkie brief on the topic with special guest Elizabeth Henneke at a later date, so be on the lookout for that. In the meantime, you can check out her website at LoneStarJusticeAlliance.org to read more about what they do. If you'd like to hear another take on this case, check out my friends over at Misconduct, a true crime podcast, as they just covered this case a couple weeks ago, too. As a podcaster, especially in this genre, you find that sometimes you inadvertently will cover the same cases as other podcasts. But no two podcasts are the same, and sometimes it's nice to hear different perspectives. Let me know what you thought about today's case. You can join my Facebook discussion group at courtjunkie.com/Facebook. You can also find me on Twitter at courtjunkiepod, on Instagram at courtjunkie, or you can email me at podcast@courtjunkie.com. A special thank you to my Patreon supporters who help keep this show up and running. Today, I want to send a shout out to Carrie, Richard, Nick, Justin, and Jennifer. Thank you so much for your support. If you'd like to support this podcast, please visit courtjunkie.com/support, and that will redirect you to my Patreon page, where you can donate as little as $1 a month and get early, ad-free access to these episodes. And lastly, I do have some Court Junkie merch available at my online store, which you can visit at courtjunkie.com/store. There's some cool fall hoodies, coffee mugs, and even things like notebooks and phone cases. Thanks for listening. Until next time.